I never lose. I've never lost at anything in life. Never. You know? And people are like, what do you mean you've never lost? You know, you play sports, you lose. No. I either win or I learn. I never lose. That's how I live life.
Welcome to Ballers with Babies. I'm Mark Willard. Today we know so much about what athletes and sports personalities do, but not so much about who they are, what makes them tick. What's life like the moment the stadiums and TV cameras go dark? Most go home to their families. We want to know what that after-hours experience is like. Ballers with Babies explores their upbringing, their home life, how it's affected by their high-profile job, and how that high-profile job is affected by the home life. On Ballers with Babies, we talk to some of the most interesting names in sports and find out how they're even more interesting than we realized. And don't worry, diehard fan, we'll get to the important sports questions as well. This is your favorite people like you've never heard them before. I hope you enjoy. Okay, let's get him in here. Ballers with Babies with Olden Polonese. 15 seasons in the NBA, but not just any seasons, by the way. You know, you played in what I always hear referred to so often as kind of the golden age, right? Michael, and Magic, and Larry, you were there. But you know what I've noticed is different about you? I don't hear you talk about it like it was the golden age. You kind of appreciate now yes. more than some of your brethren did, oh, right?
Definitely, because I was a part of the golden age because it was a battle, man. It was, I always refer to it as WWE wrestling, you know, wrestling with a basketball. And so to me, it was a grind. Now I can really appreciate the game because, one, I'm out of it, and, two, I do like it. Aesthetically, because it's a lot more pleasing. There's not as much physicality, but again, I don't think it should be all about being physical in the NBA. You should have some sense of physicality, but you should also be able to play and shoot, and I enjoy watching it. You know?
To say you are a family man is probably the understatement of the year. Tell me about the Polonese family. How many kids? How old? Yeah, what's all going on?
Lord have mercy. There's a whole bunch of them. Oh, my God. How many do I have? My ex was really trying to push them out. When I got to the league, I was engaged to get married. And the lady I was going to marry, we had a child together. And the other four by my ex-wife. And so I have a, Lord, I have them from all the spectrum. My oldest is 31.
31?
Yeah. With two kids. I'm a grandpa. My second youngest is 22. That's Nick. He has a child. Then we go 20, 18, 16. And so it was like, you know, at first being a father early on in my career kind of like settled me down. And so it was like, I think it was great for me personally having a child, you know, while in the NBA. But because I ended up getting custody of her. And so that was pretty interesting, you know, trying to be, you know, like pretty much a full-time dad early on. But then I realized it was a lot more difficult than I thought. I still maintained custody of my child, but I ended up getting my mother and my sister to help me, you know, while I was traveling and everything else. But it's fun being a parent, you know, like they say in that one commercial, it's the only job you can't retire or quit from. So it's a continuous thing. So well, I enjoy it.
That's fascinating. I wonder what's tougher, especially your particular experience sounds quite unique. I don't know a lot of guys, professional athletes that are, you know, quote unquote, single parents. So I wonder what's tougher, trying to be a parent while you're in the league or trying to figure out how to be a family man once you're out of the league.
Oh, that's a great question. I think in the league, it might be tougher because now I know what to do. Being out the league, that's nothing. Basketball is the job. So my kids, everybody got to see me play. You know, they all enough to at least see one game.
Right.
And so I'm still dad. That's why they freak out when their friends are like, oh, my God, Olden Polonese, that's your dad. And they look at me like, and?
Yeah.
So they don't really worry about that or trip on it. They're just like, whatever, that's our dad. He's one. You know, he takes out the trash. He don't, you know, I'm a dad. That's how I've always approached it. So the basketball, again, was just the job. You know, it wasn't like, it wasn't me. It didn't define me.
You're from Haiti. You've seen and experienced a lot of strife, and a lot of it is, you know, it's a story that that I think has been well documented. But I wonder, how has that kind of affected you and the bond that you experience with those who are close to you?
Well, it's funny. I didn't know I was poor until I got to University of Virginia, and somebody, I said, yeah, I'm from Harlem. They're like, oh my God, you're from the ghetto. I'm like, the ghetto? I didn't know I was living in the ghetto the whole time I was there, because I had a place to sleep. I had food on the table. You know, it wasn't steaks and lobster and all that, but we still ate. And even when I was in Haiti, we still had a roof over our heads. And so my parents did a great job of making sure we had the essentials. And so the strife that I saw within, you know, my life was, it was different, because we just didn't look at it that way. Yeah, we were on welfare, but we used it as a positive more than a negative. And so we didn't look at it as, oh, we're dirt poor and all that. I still went to private school. You know, when I was in high school, I went to an all-boys Catholic school. My parents had to pay for that. So when they worked, you know, when they checks, you know, from work went to pay for my schooling, because they wanted to make sure I had the best education no matter what, even if they had to sacrifice everything.
It's amazing. It's almost like, so maybe your parents, and I know a lot of families who do this, it's almost like they protect their kids from knowing some of the struggles that are going on. Did you have to then sort of do the reverse with your children, because they're having a very different experience because you're playing in the NBA? Did you almost kind of have to, you know, tap down their expectations?
Oh, unfortunately, I failed at that one. I failed miserably at that one. I wanted my kids to have everything. It didn't matter what it was. Hey, you can have it. You know, it's like now that I'm retired, I'm trying to teach them all over again how to appreciate stuff. But I wanted my kids to have everything I didn't have. Yeah. You know, it's like, again, we didn't have big Christmases, but my parents made sure I had one gift. And so to me, that was still kind of cool. And I appreciate that one gift. I remember one Christmas, my kids, you know, they tearing open like 15, 20 boxes of stuff. And it's like, when they done ripping them up, okay, we're done. It was just ripping everything up. I was like, wait a minute. I remember when I had one, and it was the most amazing Christmas. These guys, they get 20, they still mad.
Yeah.
I didn't get this, I didn't get that. I'm like, come on, guys. Y'all really upsetting me right now. So, but again, I wasn't upset about it, because I wanted them to be happy regardless, because I know what I went through as a child, and it was a different kind of happiness, you know? And so, again, we always have to elevate our lives, and so I tried to give them the best, but at the same time, still teach them rules and values. But again, ooh, it was rough.
You know, also drawing on that experience that you had, not only as a child, but as an adult with things that have gone on in Haiti and, you know, the way that that's been treated by our country. I mean, I know you're a nice dude, but I also wonder, did that background create any sort of extra drive or an intensity streak that you accessed in basketball? Did it?
Oh, yeah, it definitely did. Being from Haiti, knowing that we were the first independent black nation, that stuck in my head forever. Knowing that I was from this country, I grew up there, and then I came to another country. So I have two homes, and so I had to definitely focus on my past history of all the great men of Haiti and what they did. And just like when I did my hunger strike, it was based on that premise. You know, I'm from this country. My countrymen and women are being basically persecuted for fleeing the country, for fleeing, you know, the dictatorship, and the U.S., you know, was putting them in prison. And so I had to do something about it. And I did my hunger strike during the NBA season. So again, the basketball, you know, was a great job, but I use it as a platform for everything else.
Yeah, I tell you, and is it easy to turn that on and off? You know, in other words, I mean, we know a lot of guys that, you know, they have that intensity streak in sports, sometimes that can be hard when they, you know, bring that into the regular world. Is it something that you kind of have to turn on and off?
You have to, and you have to be good at it.
Yeah.
You know, and I learned how to do it because I tell people all the time, we all are two people. You know, there's two sides to everybody. There's two sides to everything. The ones that succeed are ones that can control both sides. If you're not able to control both sides, then you're in major trouble. I can't take my intensity, and I was very intense on the court. There's no way in God's green earth I could take that intensity off the court. And the times that I did slip, I messed up, and I got in trouble for it. You know, I remember one time I got, you know, I'm very honest about my life. You know, I got pulled over by a police officer. I was speeding, but I just came from practice. So my adrenaline was still high. And so he stops me. I didn't cuss him out or nothing, but I, you know, it was the OP came out, you know, as I like to say. And so he writes the ticket out. The whole time he's saying that, man, will you hurry up and give me the ticket? Will you hurry up? Hurry up. He's like, don't rush me, sir. I'm like, dude, just hurry up, man. I got somewhere to be. I'm still on that high. He gives me the ticket, and I rip it up right in front of him and dropped it on the ground.
Wow.
And I was like, after I did that, I was like, oh, my God. God, once I came down, I was like, that was, I was so, so embarrassed at myself for doing that. And I was like, I could not believe I did that. And so it was like, dude, you, and I made a promise to myself, don't do that anymore. You know, it's like, you can't be that guy off the court.
You mentioned the hunger strike. You're clearly a man of conviction, and you're a man of feeling. When you see something, you felt like you had to do something. I wonder how have you gone about, or if you have, made an effort to kind of instill that in your children. What do they know about that story? What does it mean to them?
Well, unfortunately, my kids grew up in the social media era. They know about it. They know Dad went on a hunger strike, and he's always fighting for justice and peace, but they don't care. They, you know, they're kids. They're in this, you know, just give them their cell phone and their laptop and they're good. And so to me, you know, I still try to preach it to them that, you know, you got to do good things for others. When you're able to help others, you have to. But it's tough. Again, you know, you try to be a good parent, and being the fact that, you know, once their mom and I divorced, it made it a lot more difficult to actually preach a lot of these things. And so to me, it's still a constant battle, you know, just trying to get them to just understand that this life is not just about Fortnite and whatever, you know, they're into right now. There's more important things in this world.
Right. You know, I also wonder, you talk about that intensity that you were able to bring to the court. Do you think any of that came from draft night? I've always thought it's fascinating when somebody is like ready to start their career and somebody drafts them, and then they, you know, 15 minutes into their career, they trade them for Scottie Pippen. This is a trade that, you know, people remember. What was that like, and how did that kind of shape you as you got started?
Well, it was stalling at first because I didn't know I was going to be drafted by the Bulls. If anybody watched the video of the draft, I was ready to stand up when the Commissioner Stern said, with the fifth pick, Seattle Supersonics select, I'm about to get up because it's the only team I interviewed for.
Yeah.
I knew I was going to Seattle. Seattle told me they were going to draft me. And so I was like, okay, I'm ready to go. I didn't realize that they had made the trade the night before to help Chicago, but also to get extra picks. And so it gave me the first sense of business in the NBA, how it is. And so I settled back in my chair, and then when with the eighth pick, Chicago selects Olden Polynes, I was like, oh my God, I'm going to play with Michael Jordan. So I forgot about Seattle. Then all of a sudden, they're like, we have a trade to announce. So I was like, well, okay. You know, once they said that we were trading for each other, I'm like, okay, I'm back where I was supposed to be.
Yeah.
And again, later on, I found out that that's what happened. They had made the trade. So again, the first taste of the NBA life. But what was the drive for me has always been everybody. Yeah, Scottie's a great player and all that, but, you know, he ended up going to Chicago, and he was allowed to develop and play alongside Michael Jordan, who I think Michael Jordan can make anybody look good. when I got to Seattle, I had three All-Stars. And so my playing time was limited, even though I was one of three rookies to play in all the 82 games, you know? And so that was a major accomplishment. So, but I still had a lot of guys there that were just phenomenal players. Mm-hmm. And so time was limited for me, playing time, that is. So I just focused on just doing whatever role that I could do to get on the court, which was play defense. And so I never even focused about being an offensive threat. And so to me, that was always the drive for me. Oh, Scottie Pippen, you know, it was the worst trade ever. Every year I heard that, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to use that thing to drive my career from that moment on. It's like, if it's the worst trade ever, okay, fine. Because I was the more known commodity before Scottie. So it's not the worst trade ever. You know, I had a long career. Scottie had a long career. He may have had a couple more pieces of hardware, but we both did the same thing, made the same amount of money, you know, pretty much. You know, he may have made a little bit more than me, but we both had the same life. You know, whatever he could buy, I could buy. Whatever he could do off the court, I could do off the court. So I'm like, how is that a bad career?
Hey, do you ever think about what would have happened, though, if the trade didn't happen? Like, what if you had gone to the Bulls and played with Michael Jordan?
Well, I always try not to live with ifs. That's why I always used to joke, if my aunt had testicles, she'd be my uncle. And so that's what I live by. Yeah. So I'm good with it. You know, it is what it is. I can't go back in time. I made the best of my situation. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why I try to preach to people. Stop hanging on all this stuff. You know, you can't change it. All you can do is do the best you can do in your situation and enjoy life. That's it.
Continuing with Olden Polonese, 15 years in the NBA on Ballers with Babies. Let's go back to Haiti for a second. It's been, what, 8 years now? About right since the terrible earthquake, and I know there have been some other things that have gone there since then. But what was that like for you and your family?
Man, it was rough when that earthquake hit. I was actually at a funeral.
Oh my gosh!
I was at a funeral. My girlfriend at the time, her father had just passed, and so no, her uncle. I'm sorry, her uncle, and we were at the funeral, and we walked by where her father's gravesite was, and she points at, you know, my father, because they both had the same name, Lester, her dad and my dad. And she go, and as I was standing in front of his tombstone, I get a hit on my phone. You know, there's an earthquake in Haiti. And I start freaking out because my dad was still down there and other family members. And needless to say, you know, it was like all the phones were out, couldn't reach my dad, couldn't reach aunts and uncles, couldn't reach anybody. And finally, they found my dad alive, but we had lost like six other family members in the earthquake. So it was really rough. My mom was stressed the heck out. And so it was one of those situations, you know, you pray and hope that it never happens to you, and it did. And so, but it's something I hope no one ever has to go through that, man. But I know, unfortunately, we're always going to have natural disasters. And it's kind of weird, you know, an earthquake in Haiti. That's kind of weird, but, you know, because we've never experienced that.
Right.
And so that's why so many people die, because they don't know what to do. It's not unfamiliar territory.
Yeah, it's not fair for it.
Hurricane? Oh, sure. Yeah, we know. We know what to do with a hurricane.
Kick back, open up
a drink. Yeah, we know what to do with a hurricane. But earthquake, that was like, hey.
You know, I mean, this all led to that moment on television when you went on Dr. Phil, when they brought your dad on, and you hadn't seen him in some time after this. And I have to tell you, I mean, it was a beautiful moment. What do you recall about that moment?
Man, I had spoken to him the night before. We did might have been ABC, and we did the live feed, and I could see him on the screen. And I was like, oh my God, because I hadn't seen my dad in like 2 years since he went back, because I used to see him all the time. And so he basically moved back to Haiti. So after the earthquake, we spoke, and you know, he was alive. And so he's in New York City. But I didn't realize they had flown him out already. I'm thinking he's in New York. He's in L.A. the whole time. And so, but I didn't know this. And so when I went on Dr. Phil's show, it's like, you know, we're sitting there and he's up in there talking to me. And next thing I know, my dad's standing behind me. And the emotions that came out, it was everything. It's like the fact that I was happy to see him. You know, it's like, this is my dad. You know, he made it possible for me to be where I am. Everything ran through my head in 1 second. And it was just the most amazing feeling. You know, it's like, oh my God. Because I remember when the earthquake hit and we couldn't find him, natural instincts is to go to the worst
sure.
possible place.
How long was it from the earthquake until you felt like that gap was how long when you didn't know if he was alive?
Oh, it was 3 days.
3 days.
It was 3 days.
Ugh.
It was 3 days of no word, no contact, nothing. It was 3 days. And we're freaking out. Everybody. My mom's hysterical. And my mom has a heart condition. Both my parents are gone now, but it's just like, you know, trying to keep her calm. It was like my sister's going crazy. My brother's like, everybody's flying in town. It's like, we don't know what to do, you know? It's like, okay, I'm about to get on a plane and go down there. It's like, what are you gonna do down there? I ended up going down there. You know, the stench of everything was so bad, I came right back. It was like nauseating. It was nauseating. And people don't realize what you saw on TV was nowhere near what was really going on the ground at all, not even close.
How did you finally find out? Did you, like, was there a phone call? Like, whoa.
My sister called me and said, we found him. And that's all she said. And I was like, really? It's like, yeah, we found him. He's okay. He knew what to do. Yeah. But the phones weren't working. So he couldn't reach anybody. Because my dad, you know, he's been here forever. So he knew about earthquakes. He was here for Northridge. You know,
yeah.
They were actually visiting me when Northridge hit.
So he was the only guy down there that knew what to do. Unbelievable. So we talked about it earlier that you're someone, I think, who is, you know, you stay in tune with now. You stay in the present. I had a dad who was like that for many years, and I always attributed it to the fact that he's a high school teacher. So it wasn't just a dad. He was around kids all the time. I wonder if it's the same for you. You're a dad. You also do a lot of stuff with camps. You're around youth all the time. Is that a kind of an attachment you've made in your mind before?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I love being around kids. If I could just work with kids the rest of my life, I'd be happy. That's why I want to coach. That's why, you know, I've been coaching, but I want to coach more and more because any part of my knowledge I can embark on a kid, whether it's good or bad, I believe that you should always share the good and the bad with kids, you know, and help them out. It's the old saying, you know, like our parents are always telling us, you know, don't touch that stove, it's hot. Don't touch that stove, it's hot. But what do? We go touch the stove.
Yeah.
It's human nature. So, I'm like, so my thing is I'm trying to get you to the point where you don't have to touch the stove. Just trust my words and my experiences. Okay, just believe in that, and that's what I'm trying to teach them. So when I do all the camps and clinics, you know, plus it's selfish also for me that I do it, because they keep me young.
Yeah,
their energy, I feel it, and it really, I swear to you, it keeps me young. It makes me so happy. A day at camp is one of the happiest days for me. You know, I'm there for 6, 7, 8 hours, but it's the best 8 hours that I have in that day, and the rest of the day doesn't even compare. So to me, that's what I strive for, and I'm always trying to use the basketball to teach them life. You know, I'm parental, even though they're not my kids, I still look at them as, you know, as mine, because I'm in charge.
Yeah,
it does, and I do believe in that. It does take a village. There's sometimes I want to snatch them up and pull the belt off and whoop them, but you know, I can't do that part. But actually, I never hit my kids.
That's good, too.
That's good. Oh, no. I didn't want to do that one. Ooh, my parents, they hit us back then. I used to tell people, my parents would be in prison right now for the stuff they did to us.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They'd be in prison. It was called rearing your child back then. We call it child abuse now. It was rough.
What'd they do?
Everything. Extension cord. I get hit with this cord here. It didn't matter. Belts. Sometimes the belt slip, you get hit with the buckle. But you know what? It never diminished that love, you know, in my eyes. It's like, you know what? I messed up. I did do that. But that's what we were all used to.
Yeah.
But, you know, as I grew up and everything, I became a parent. I'm like, oh, no, I can't do that to my kids.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it evolved. So that didn't scar you in any sort
of
way?
No, not at all. Not at all. You know, because it wasn't like every day, and it wasn't like without cause. Right. It's not like dad walked in one day, it's like, oh no, there was always cause for every last one of us. You know, like we're fighting, you know, hammers flying through the house, you know, you knocking your sister's tooth out, stuff like
that. My sister did that to me too, actually. But we didn't get whipped afterwards.
Oh man.
So, you know what I love about what you were just talking about with the camps? You've transitioned to something and found new passion, which I think is really hard for anybody who's in a career like you guys that ends, you know, before or right around when you're 35 or 40 years old. So what else about that transition to life and business? It can have pitfalls, right? I remember you telling me a story of owning a business, started out real good, and then it kind of turned really bad.
Turned really bad.
Yeah, what happened there?
Well, that was while I was playing. Because one of the things I always wanted to do, and I learned from other individuals that played in the league and other sports, you know, set everything up while you're in the NBA. That's what they used to tell me. Set everything up while you're still playing. That way, because all the doors are open then, whatever it is you want to do. And so I was, you know, I did a bunch of different businesses, some good, some not so good. I had a children's clothing store. It was great. We were making money hand over fist. But my ex-wife wanted to be around me, and she was the one running the business. And so when I signed with Seattle, she leaves Sacramento to come join me. I mean, I don't mind that, but if you're going to leave me, at least find somebody that can replace you. And like the old saying, no one can do it better than you.
Yep.
And so, unfortunately, she finds somebody that was not so honest. Next thing we know, the business is failing. And I'm talking about, I was only with Seattle for a year. We're talking about like within 3 to 5 months. It was a wrap. The whole store, it's like, we're in a deficit? How are we in a deficit? And so, to me, that was another lesson learned. It's like, do it yourself. And so, I think that's one of the main things that caused my divorce, or the decline of my marriage. Because I was like, hey, you got to just stay here. There's a bunch of families that are able to do that. You know, you stay in Sacramento, because that was home for us. Stay home. Raise the kids, run the business. I'm going to go to Seattle for 1 year, and then we'll figure everything else out. But she didn't even allow that to happen. So, you know, I've had those moments in business. But, again, you live and learn.
Yep.
And so that's why now I strictly deal with kids, running camps, clinics, doing basketball training, because I can control that. So because the trainer is me. The coach is me.
The business is you.
The business is me. And so I can't get somebody else to do it because I'm the one. And so it's a lot better for me now.
That coaching, I mean, and handing out lessons, it seems to fit you so well. I want to go to something you just tweeted last month during the NBA draft. Congrats to all the young men that are drafted tonight. It's the beginning and not a final destination. Work hard, listen, and keep your circle small. Others made money off you in college. Now you're finally getting paid for your talents. Good luck. What's really the key to that message there? Why are you saying keep your circle small?
Keep it small, man. That's the best advice I can give anybody coming into the NBA or any sport. If you're making money, you got to remember, most of these kids grew up poor. They're growing up poor. You know, single mom, single dad, whatever it is. They've never seen $1 million. I never could have gone to my dad, I just got to, you know, I signed a 5-year deal. My first contract, 5 years, $2.5 million. Okay? My first year check was $375. My dad ain't never seen $375,000. How's he going to help me manage $375,000?
Right.
There's no such thing. And so to me, you keep your circle small because everybody's going to come in. everybody, and they're gonna be disguised. They're gonna come in. They'll be the one guy, and I always try to tell them this. There's gonna be the, and I was hoping somebody reached out to me. There's gonna be the one guy that's gonna. I'm telling you right now, he's gonna like be the coolest dude in the world. He's gonna be the most honest, straight up dude. Okay, because that's his role until he gets in. You're going to think, oh, my God, I've never met anybody like this. But the minute he's in, he's going to take you for everything you got. You know, there's going to be the guy that, you know, he's going to act like he has a lot of money, has nothing. Because he's going to, like, try to make you, oh, you know, I'm okay because I have money. I don't need his money. But he has nothing. He's already built that foundation to where he can milk you and make you believe that he has the money. You know, so there's all these types of people. There's going to be the family members coming in. Hey, remember when you were little and I babysat you? Well, I need about $150,000 for that. You're going to run into all that stuff. So what you need to do is like, okay, if it's your mom and dad, you sit them down and you have a talk with them. Okay, this is what's going to happen. And I always try to tell them, try to find a company that has something to lose. Don't get individual agents and lawyers. No, find somebody that has something to lose. Go with a big company. It's okay to go with a big company because if anything goes awry, you have legal recourse. You know, a lot of these guys, oh yeah, I'm gonna go with my uncle. You know, he had a couple of classes at night school, you know, stuff like that. I'm gonna go with my friend. You know, he's studying right now to be a now. LeBron made that work, but LeBron still has a major company behind him. And that's what people don't realize. He just put all his friends in position, mm-hmm. you know. Instead of giving them money, he's like, hey, work for it. Make them work for it. Don't just give away the money. Make them work for it.
Speaking of giving out advice and some of the big guys in the game today, I found this, and this was advice that you wanted to give to DeMarcus Cousins recently in the news, of course. This was 5 years ago, and you said a lot of times as athletes, we think we're superhuman, we're above the law, we're this and that. At the end of the day, we're not. It doesn't matter if you have an argument with a coach or you have a problem with a coach, you can't undermine a coach. Because I know I've done that. I didn't undermine, but I've argued with coaches, and it served no good purpose at the end of the day. Even if I was right, I'm still wrong. Why do you think DeMarcus needed to hear that? And does he still?
He did. Back then when he was in Sacramento, he undermined the coaches. And I was there at the time. George Karl was going to bring me in as one of his assistants. Vlade shut that down.
Really?
Again, friends, where are they when you need them?
Why did Vlade shoot it down?
Because Vlade is Vlade. He's different now. This is a guy, we shared the same agent, okay? And so to me, that's how it is now in this league. If you guys have that connection, you look out for each other. Why is it different for me? Vlade and I used to vacation together. We hung out. That was my buddy.
Yeah.
And my stress level was not because of Vlade. I was like, man, I don't think I can get George Karl to accept to bring me on. George Karl was like, yes, I'd love to have you. And it was Vlade that shot it down. I was like, oh, my God. So, but at the time, I knew the kind of coach George Karl was. You know, he's going to be tough on young guys, but he's fair. And so DeMarcus went into this whole, you know, it's my way, I'm the man, and it never works. And so fast forward to now, you see that. I don't care how injured you are. You're still the best center in the NBA. How do you not get offers? It's because of all of that stuff. That's the problem right now. DeMarcus Cousins with a bad Achilles is still better than 80% of the guys in the league. And yet, he got no major offers. He had to call the Warriors, and the Warriors said, oh, yeah, well, sure, well, sure.
Will being in a culture like that fix it all up?
Yes, it will. Because another guy who I work with and trained, JaVale McGee, he went through that. You know, he was aloof, he was a dummy, and he's a smart young man. You know, everybody, oh, he's done. He gets to the Warriors. Now he looks, you know, yeah, he had some moments of shafting a fool, but, you know, for the most part, they were very, very limited.
Yes.
You know, Nick Young had an exceptional season. Didn't, not what he wanted, but there were no problems. You know, the warrior culture has already been established. So a guy like DeMarcus, he's going to come in there. And to me, one of the things that I did see when I was in Sacramento for those few short weeks, DeMarcus is not a bad guy. DeMarcus hates losing. That's what I saw. And I saw it in a practice. His team was losing. He just went crazy. He can't stand losing. And so that's what was causing his angst and anger. And so to me, being with the Warriors, yeah, they'll lose some games, but I mean, you pretty much guaranteed a finals appearance. And so to me, that's going to take away from his anger. And so now all he has to do is get healthy and give him a couple minutes, and he'll be right back in the free agent market next year. So to me, it was a great move. It was a stroke of genius by Morris to even say, yeah, let's do it.
Yeah.
It's crazy. The rich got richer.
Unbelievable. Hey, let's go back for a second because you mentioned this earlier. How'd you end up at Virginia?
Long story, short story. Actually, it was really easy. Two reasons, you know, and again, I'm one of the most direct and honest people in the world. They got me. You know, like the kids we say now, got them. I went on my visit and, well, let me go back a little bit. My high school coach and Jim Larranaga are best friends. They grew up together.
Okay.
So I pretty much knew I was going to go there only because I got somebody that knows my coach. And this man I revered, my high school coach, John Carey. He's my second father. It's like, there's nothing anybody can say about him to me. That man made me who I am. And so as long as I knew I had somebody at Virginia, there was nobody else at any other schools I was looking at, you know. And plus, it got me away from New York. And I wanted to be out of New York. I wanted to go somewhere where I can have fun and just enjoy life and grow up. I got to Virginia on my visit. It's beautiful.
Right.
Oh, my goodness. The most beautiful landscapes. The air smells different than New York. You know, I got my first steak dinner. And so I'm really into all of this, into my visit. Then they took me out. Ralph Sampson was showing me around. They took me to a party. I went to all-boys school. I've never been around, you know, other than seeing girls on the train. I've never been to a party and all that. Man, I lost my damn mind. Shoot. These women were so beautiful, man. I was like, oh, my God. I ain't going nowhere else. I don't want no more visits. I don't want nothing. I'm coming here. That was it for me. There were these twins, Kim and Karen Hatchett. Oh, my Lord. They had me at hello. I'm telling you.
Oh, my gosh.
Hey, the truth is the truth, man. I'm not going to say, oh, well, because for education. No, they had me at hello. And I knew they had a great school system. I mean, yes, Virginia's one of the top academic schools. But they had me at hello.
Did you have any regrets from your time there?
Not at all.
None.
Not at all. I mean,
you left a little early, right?
I left after my junior year. Okay. And so, but it was like, you know what? I don't have regrets because every experience is a building block. Every single experience, good, bad, and different, it's a building block. You know, and so that's how I always look at things. I never look at it past that. You know, I've learned this over the years, you know, and it's funny. I never lose. I've never lost at anything in life. Never. You know, and people are like, what do you mean you've never lost? You know, you play sports, you lose. No, I either win or I learn. I never lose. That's how I live life.
I love that. All right, home stretch with Olden Polynice. Let's stick to sports. Okay, I know even in the final hour, you thought LeBron was going to be staying in Cleveland, but when he didn't.
Okay, go ahead.
Hold on. When he didn't, immediately went to social media. You congratulated Magic Johnson when he announced LA. So what are your thoughts, and what's the ripple effect now through the NBA?
Okay, first off, if you go back with all the work we've done, I said he was coming to LA.
You did. Okay. I just mean the day of.
But the day of, I was like, you know what? I think he should stay in Cleveland. I think he's going to stay in Cleveland because that, to me, is the best place for him.
Okay.
Because I thought his supporting cast is better in Cleveland than in L.A. And so maybe I was hedging my bet a little bit. Yeah. But I originally said he was going to L.A. But with that being said, okay, I thought he was going to do it. He shocked all of us. You know, I honestly didn't think he was going to go to the Lakers. Yeah. At the end of the day, in my heart of hearts, I was like, there's no way. Even though I had made that prediction a while back, there's no way he's going to come to the Lakers because you're the seventh best Laker, maybe. Maybe the eighth best, ninth best. We ain't even added James Worthy in the mix. We always mention everybody, Goodridge, West, Baylor, and we don't even mention, you know, a guy like James Worthy, who was phenomenal. And so to me, that's why I was like, would he really want to do that? Because you're going to have to win four titles in your 4 years to even be in the same conversation.
You think so?
Oh, I believe so. Come on.
If he comes out of there with even a title, with what the Lakers have been through.
Okay, they're not going to get it. Come on now.
Well, they're not going to get it right away.
He's 33 years old with a 37-year-old body.
It's still a building story, right?
What he's 33 years old chronologically.
Yeah, but what if Kawhi
But his comes? Body is 37. He's got an extra 4 years of mileage. Kawhi comes. Kawhi has never said it was the Lakers. All he said was L.A.
Fair point.
That's all he said. He never said Lakers.
He actually hasn't said anything.
Yeah, true that. But it's like, hey, Clippers could be a possibility. And the reason why I don't think Kawhi is going to happen here, because like I said, unless the Lakers give up certain pieces that they definitely don't want to, Pop ain't helping the Lakers out. Come on. You think Popovich and Buford are going to, let's help the Lakers get better.
Only if Kawhi forces him to.
If Kawhi forces him to, they still going to say, give us A, B, C, and D.
Right. Does the NBA have a problem now because of the balance of power, right, with what DeMarcus did, with what LeBron did, and everything is in the West? Is this an issue or not?
We thought that when the Warriors won 73 games. We thought that when Michael Jordan was running roughshod through the league. We thought that when Magic was, it's always the case. There's no problem. I mean, I think that was one of my tweets. Stop complaining about the Warriors and LeBron and get your butts in the gym. That's it. The problem the NBA has nothing to do with that. The problem the NBA has is that these teams don't put it on the players and keep them accountable to getting better. These guys hang out. We did it. Magic, Jordan, I used to hang out with all these guys. We all hung out. We partied, but we knew how to get in the gym and work on our craft. They're not doing that anymore. Everybody just wants to hang out and party and, you know, go to strip clubs and everything else. I'm like, come on, dude. At some point in time, you have to focus on your craft and get better. Don't be bitter. Be better.
It also feels like people think this is different than it's ever been in the NBA. And we can look back and, I mean, it's always three or four teams at the beginning of the year and we can say, well, those are the teams. And I know right now maybe it's one, but didn't it feel like that with Michael's Bulls when you were playing? In other words, like, is it really different now or is it the exact same thing it's always been?
I did a blog years ago. I've been saying this, Mark. It's always that way. They sell a bill of goods to about 24 other franchises. Okay, but realistically, there's only six possible championship caliber teams. Okay, and when I wrote that back then, I was at six. Maybe it's five or four now. But that's it. Everybody else, you really think Sacramento has a chance to win a championship?
Of course not.
Brooklyn?
No.
Indiana?
No, we can say them right now.
Yeah, we can name every last one of them.
It's Rockets, Lakers, Warriors, Philly, Boston. That might be it.
Five. And maybe Oklahoma City kind of kicks in gear.
Yeah, right.
Okay. So that's it.
That's it.
We'll never get to 7 or 8. That's it. It was 6 10 years ago when I put that blog out there. It was 6. When I was on the Clippers in 91, We knew we weren't going to the finals. I knew that, but I was like, you know what? Let's see how far we can get. I played for Seattle. We knocked Houston out in the first round. That was it. We had the Lakers the next round. We knew they were better. Come on, Magic, Kareem. That's it.
Yep.
That's as far as we're going to get. No matter how hard we try, the talent level is just that much better than us.
This is a real treat to do this. Thank you so much
my pleasure,
for
man.
Spending
my pleasure.
Some time with me. Love
my
it.
My pleasure.